Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, hoping you're having a nice day. We're here to talk about the hope that all conditions can be improved, no matter what the state you're in now. I've seen so many people who have had problems. They were told, sorry, nothing can be done. You're just going to have to learn to live with it. Well, lo and behold, they made some changes and they no longer have those conditions. So you name the condition, I can show you individuals who've made improvements or completely recovered. That's what this program's about. Recovering from problems, environmental, emotional, physiological, whatever it may be. And today we're going to take some time to see what are the issues you would like to address that you find important. Now, I've been calling different stations around the country and having their audience call in their questions. And it's interesting the type of questions that are raised in New Mexico versus Los Angeles versus Houston and New York. So for those of you who would like to call in today, we're just going to take calls today because of a little technical problem we're trying to overcome and will in the next day or two from our New York area audience. And that number in New York is 212-279-2900. I believe that's correct. Is that right, Michael? That's
212-209-2900, Gary.
Thank you. So as soon as you call in, we'll be able to get you up on the air and see what the issues are and address them in as positive and constructive manner as possible. Again, that's 212-279-2900. Before we go there, let me share some of the latest in health and nutrition update information with you. This comes from The Ecologist, Volume 29, Number 7. It's a very interesting article, very provocative one. It is called Victims of the Nuclear Age. You'd say, what victims? Yes, there were some stupid above-ground experiments where the armed forces put soldiers right out there with nothing more than what amounted to sunglasses and told them, look at the nuclear explosion. Maybe they were not aware that there would be fallout. Maybe they were not aware that this would lead to bone cancers and defective immune systems in our fathers. Well, it did. But that's not the big issue. Far, far, far and away more poor people were exposed in ways that we were not made aware of that were dangerous. Here's what the article says, and I'll quote, up to 1,300,000,000 people have been killed, maimed, or diseased by nuclear power since its inception. The industry's figures massively understate the real cost of nuclear power in an attempt to hide its victims from the world. Now, this is by Dr. Rosalie Bertel. On the 10th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, I was standing at a public meeting in Kyiv, Ukraine, listening to the story of one of the firemen employed to clean up the site after the explosion. These workers took huge risks and also huge doses of radiation during this task, and their story is a terrifying one. About 600,000 men were conscripted at Chernobyl, farmers, factory workers, miners, soldiers, as well as professionals like the firemen from all across Russia. Some of these men lifted pieces of radioactive metal with their bare hands. They had to fight more than 300 fires created by the chunks of burning material spewed off by the inferno. They buried trucks, fire engines, cars, and all sorts of personal belongings. They felled a forest and completely burned it, removed topsoil, bulldozed houses, and filled all available clay-lined trenches with radioactive debris. The minimal conscription time was 180 days, but many stayed for a year. Some were threatened with severe punishment to their families if they failed to stay and do their duty. These people who were called liquidators are now discarded and forgotten, many vainly trying to establish that the ill health most have suffered since 1986 is the result of their massive exposure to radiation. At the Center for Radiation Research outside of Kyiv, there's an organization of former liquidators. This group reports that by 1995, 13,000 of their members had died, almost 20% of which deaths were suicides. About 70,000 members were estimated to be permanently disabled. But the members of this organization are the lucky ones, because many former liquidators are now scattered throughout Russia. They neither had the benefit of the organization's special hospital, nor the membership of a survivor organization. They are known as the Living Dead. The fireman whose story I was listening to seemed to be an exception to the grim litany of illnesses and death. He was telling the meeting how pleased and excited that he was for the first time in 10 years. His blood test findings were in the normal range. I was standing next to a delegate from the International Atomic Energy Commission, the organization charged with promoting the use of atomic energy. On hearing the fireman's story, he leaned over to me and said, "You see, we said there were only transient disorders." A rough translation might read, "Chernobyl, what's the problem?" Let's take a look at what happens when we ignore the victims. The International Atomic Energy Association's man's attitude was perfectly in keeping with that of his organization, which, along with the International Commission on Radiation Protection, exists in practice largely to play down the effects of radiation on human health and to shield the nuclear industry from compensation claims from the public. The International Atomic Energy Association was set up in the late 1950s by the UN to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and to promote the peaceful use of atomic energy. Ironically, two contradictory objectives. The ICRP, which evolved from the 1928 International Committee on X-ray and Radium Protection, was set up in the 50s to explore the health effects of radiation and theoretically to protect the public from it. In fact, both organizations have come to serve the industry rather than the public. The Chernobyl case is a classic example of the inadequacy and questionable sciences involved. Despite massive evidence to the contrary, not least from the many thousands of victims themselves, these associations insist that only 32 people have died so far as a result of Chernobyl, those who died in the radiation ward of Hospital 6 in Moscow. All other deaths related to the disaster and its aftermath, and there have been more than 10,000 in the Ukraine alone, according to the Ministry of Health, are ignored. Belarus had the highest fallout, and yet there is an international blackout among the associations and the rest of the radiation-protecting communities on the suffering of its people. Quite simply, they don't exist. The essential problem is that both of these organizations, the International Atomic Energy Group and the ICPR, are not dealing with science but with politics and administration. Not with public health, but with maintaining an increasingly dubious history. It is their interest and those of the nuclear industry to play down the health effects of radiation. The main way in which the radiation protection industries are succeeded in hugely underrating the ill effect caused by nuclear power is by insisting on a group of extremely restrictive definitions as to what qualifies as a radiation-caused illness statistic. For example, under one of their criteria, if a radiation-caused cancer is not fatal, it simply isn't counted as having been caused by radiation. If a cancer is initiated by another carcinogen, but accelerated or promoted by exposure to radiation, it's not counted either. If an autoimmune disease or any non-cancer is caused by radiation, it is not counted. Radiation-damaged embryos or fetuses which result in miscarriage or stillbirth are not counted. A congenitally blind, deaf, dumb, malformed child whose illnesses are radiation-related are not included either, because this is not genetic damage, but rather teratogenic damage, and will not be passed on later to the child's offspring, so they assume. Causing the genetic predisposition to breast cancer or heart disease does not count, since it is not a serious genetic disease in their mind. Even if radiation causes a fatal cancer or serious genetic disease in a live, born infant, it is discounted if the estimated radiation dose is below 100 millimeasures of radiation exposure. Again, totally discounted. Even if radiation causes a lung cancer, it does not count if that lung cancer sufferer smokes. In fact, whenever there is a possibility of another cause, radiation is always said not to be at cause. If all else fails, it is possible to claim that radiation below some designated dose does not cause cancer in anyone, and then average over the whole body the radiation dose which has actually been received by one part of the body or organ, as for instance when radioiodine concentration in the thyroid. This arbitrary dilution of the dose will ensure that the cutoff point is nowhere near reached. It is a technique used to dismiss the sickness of Gulf War veterans who inhaled small particles of ceramic uranium, which stayed in their lungs for more than 2 years and in their bodies for more than 8 years, irradiating and damaging cells in a particular part of the body. Despite the authorities' attempts at concealment, we can still begin to enumerate the real victims of the nuclear age. Although the calculations and statistics which I have brought to bear below do not include all the human suffering that has been caused by the nuclear age, a closer look will show that the methodology is adequate for a first estimate of major damage. The magnitude of the harm already caused is startling, and even more so when we realize how many of the damages may have been omitted from the first estimate. In my estimate, cancer, whether fatal or non-fatal, excluding non-fatal skin cancer, genetic damage, and serious congenital malformations and diseases will be included in the figures. Other damage is acknowledged but not estimated. Ultimately, whether or not one cares about the damage caused by radiation exposure is ultimately a human, not a scientific question. Damage is damage. And causing an unwanted attack on someone's person or reproductive capacity is a violation of human rights. Such damage can be rated with importance, but it should not be arbitrarily ignored. Statistics are the people with the tears wiped away, said one of the people of the Republic of the Marshall Islands who hosted the U.S. Bikini nuclear testing in the 1950s. This is the story of many tears and of a hard-hearted mindset that laid down the degree of suffering and ill health that would be considered acceptable. And that is a price to pay for the word benefiting from nuclear technology. In order to estimate the real victims in the nuclear industry, as opposed to those figures enumerated by the organizations and other nuclear apologists, I will take the customary risk estimates, indicate their probable range of error, and then extend the definition to cover related events not recognized as determinants by the regulators. For example, while the nuclear regulatory agencies only take fatal cancers into consideration as detriments by the regulators, others, especially those who endure a non-fatal cancer, may find it their suffering equally worthy of consideration. And limiting genetic effects to live-born offspring does not wipe out the tears of a family that has endured a spontaneous miscarriage or stillbirth. In 1991, the agencies concluded that the projected lifetime risk of fatal cancer for members of the population exposed whole body radiation at a low dose rate was between 7 and 11 excess fatal cancers and 7 to 8 excess fatal cancers for the nuclear industry's 25 to 60-year-olds. We extended these estimates to non-fatal cancers by estimating the total number of cancers which were used by the organization in order to obtain the number of fatalities. We therefore estimate that 16 fatal and non-fatal cancers if we exclude non-fatal skin cancers. The estimate I use for cancer, 16 per 100 person sieverts, but the reader can adjust the estimate to suit his or her inclusion or exclusion or uncertainties. According to the Committee on Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, in their report, a dose of 100 MSVs to human male testes will cause temporary sterility. A single dose of 3.5 SV will cause permanent sterility. According to the same report, Just 5 MSVs to the testes will cause damage to offspring, yet this dose was permitted yearly to members of the public and 10 times more to the nuclear workers in all countries prior to 1990. It continues today to be permitted yearly for nuclear workers in most countries. Women carry with them all of the ova from birth which they will ever have. The threshold for permanent female sterilization decreases with age, but in general, about 650 MSV is considered to be the threshold for temporary sterility in women. After the Bravo event, the detonation of the hydrogen bomb at the Bikini Atoll in the Pacific in March 1954, the women of Rongelap Atoll experienced a 5 years of sterility. As they regain their sterility, they experience faulty pregnancies, miscarriages, stillbirths, and damage to their offspring. Since some radionucleosides can be retained in bone or fatty tissue, they are able to cross the placental barrier and disrupt the developing embryos or fetuses. The radionucleotides in the mother's body can also be transferred in her breast milk. The official nuclear industry definition of detriment includes only serious genetic disease not judged to be serious and teratogenic diseases. Those which are not passed on to offspring are not counted. Recently, the committee made one small concession in recognizing mental retardation in children exposed to radiation during the 5th to the 15th weeks of their mother's pregnancy. Remember, radiation kills brain cells, causing both an underdeveloped brain and a mental retardation. For the individual child, this estimates that a dose in utero of 100 to 500 MSV can cause a range of problems from poor school performance to severe mental retardation. The UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation agreed that a population of 1 million live births exposed to 100-person cyberts will result in 1 to 3 genetic damage effects to offspring and so to the human gene pool. The doubling dose of genetic effects, the dose that will cause twice as many genetic effects, is more contentious, with some geneticists claiming that it is 2.5 SVs and others claiming it's much greater sensitivity. But in any case, it means that many individuals are being born with these genetic defects. Now, what does this mean? What it means is, and I'll summarize this very briefly, that over 1,300,000,000 people have been exposed in the last 50 years to the effects of all this nuclear radiation, the nuclear fallouts, the Chernobyls, the Three Mile Islands, the Hartford, the Savannah plants, all of these, plus the excess use of x-rays. And we have been told none of this. Everything has been a major effort to cover it up. Unfortunately, even Jimmy Carter has not been forthright and honest about what Admiral Rickover found in his own report investigation on Three Mile Island. I would be hopeful that he would finally one day come forward and tell us the truth on that. So the next time you hear someone talking about the money we need for more nuclear generators and that it's a safe industry, please understand it is not. And therefore, we should do all we can to start to dismantle this legacy, honor the people who've been victimized by it, educate the public to the true nature of the damaging effects of low-level radiation and higher ionizing radiation, and stop being so concerned with covering up and start being far more concerned with helping people. I want to thank her for her report. Again, she is a lone voice out there, along with Alice Stewart, Ernest Sternglass, and Jay Gould. I'm Gary Nall, talking about health and nutrition. One last thing here on electromagnetic radiation. Now, this is the non-ionizing type, and we were told this was safe. Think again. This comes from Reuters. American scientists have uncovered a high rate of suicide among electric utility workers and suspect it is linked to electromagnetic fields and their possible effect on the brain chemical melatonin. Dr. David Savitz and researchers at the University of North Carolina think the electromagnetic fields may decrease levels of melatonin and that this may cause depression and suicide. Melatonin is linked to a variety of functions in the body, including sleep, hunger, sexual desire, and mood. In a study reported in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, they compared levels of exposure to magnetic fields and the rate of suicide among more than 5,000 electrical workers and an equal number of other men. The number of suicides among electrical workers was twice as high as in the control group. Now, that's for electrical workers. Think about this. Think about all the telephone workers, the people who are, you know, you call in and ask for a telephone number, they're in front of a computer. Think of all the computer workers in America. That's bad for the immune system, unless you have a shield. Think of, or magnetic cushion, think of all the people sleeping with a digital clock near their bed so they can see the time. Think of the people using sleeping blankets that are heated. And those who cook and are around microwave ovens. Kids who sit close to or lay close to the television set. People using cellular phones. These are all sources of electromagnetic pollution. Even a hair blower. In fact, a hair blower gives off a lot of electromagnetic pollution. Someone should do a study on the effects on people working in beauty salons who use these. Once again, we have two ways of looking at a problem. Not just what we do once we're affected. How could we have caused it? What could have caused it? And these are some things that we should pay attention to because they can help prevent problems. Let's go to our phones now, see who's on the line. Please turn off your radio when you come online so we don't get any feedback. What's your name, please? You're on the air. Speak up. You're on the air. We'll take another call. Michael. All right. Let's see who else we have. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I know that chelation is the best way to get lead out of your system. But I was wondering, what are the natural ways as well?
Any agent that can naturally chelate will be a benefit. Anything that has sulfur is a natural chelating agent. Therefore, MSM, that is good at about 500 milligrams. Your sulfur-bearing amino acids, that would be good. I would also suggest in the food, garlic, onions, shallot, those are all good. Mustard and mustard sprouts is a good chelator. And then you have to look at vitamin C, quercetin, glutathione. Those are also natural chelators. So any of the above would be a good natural chelator, but understand, there's a time when you need an acute treatment versus a chronic treatment. And you have to look at the circumstances of both. Lead does a lot to the body that we have not been made aware of, but we should. If you knew all the things that lead is in and how we're exposed, I'm quite sure that you would not want to have anything to do with lead anymore. It is a major problem. In fact, there was an article by Jamie Lincoln Kittman on the secret history of lead. And in that report, it talked about that the next time that you think about going into a gas station and the gas pump reads unleaded, you're going to think, well, okay, good, because someone has taken the lead out of gasoline. You'd be wrong. There's no lead in gasoline unless somebody puts it there. And a little more than 75 years ago, some of America's leading corporations, now who would that be? That would be Standard Oil of New Jersey, which today is Exxon, General Motors, DuPont. They were the people who caused that lead to be put there. And they knew it was a poison then, but it was profitable. Lead was outlawed as an automotive gasoline additive in 1986. It took 60 years to do that, to enable the use of emission-reduced catalytic converters in cars, which are contaminated and rendered useless by lead, and to take an honest look at what does lead do to our systems and to our environment. And since the virtual disappearance of leaded gasoline in the United States, it's still sold for use in propeller airplanes. The mean blood levels of the population have declined by 75%. But it's still estimated that 5,000 Americans died annually from lead-related heart disease alone prior to the lead phase-out. And there was a report to Congress on from the agency's Toxic Substance and Disease Registry that had an enormous amount, 2 million children, having excess lead. And here's a question. How did lead get in everywhere to begin with? Well, and why is leaded gas still being sold in Third World and Eastern Europe and elsewhere? There were some documents that were uncovered, and which gives us a very good understanding. In fact, there was an article in The Nation that talked about the true history of lead and the sad and sordid ventures that that would work their way into commercializing products that had this. Consider that the severe health hazards of lead in your body. There is no safe level of lead in the body. That's for one thing. And the government was fully appraised of leaded gasoline's potential hazardous effects and was aware, according to documents, of available alternatives, yet was complicit in the cover-up and even actively assisted the profiteers in spreading use of leaded gasoline to foreign countries. And the benefits of lead anti-knock additives were wildly and knowingly overstated in the beginning, and still are to this day. And for more than 40 years, all scientific research regarding the health implications of leaded gasoline was underwritten and controlled by DuPont and General Motors and Standard Oil. So everything was a pro-lead view. And so when they were confronted in recent years with declining sales in their biggest Western markets, owing to the phase-out imposed by the United States, Europe became the hot commodity for their leaded products. And they have no compunction about selling something that would be too dangerous for our health to other countries. Now, what does that tell you about the ethics of these corporations, their board of directors, their shareholders? Who should know this? Now, you can choose whether you smoke, but you can't pick up the air you breathe and move it somewhere else and bring in some non-polluted air, even if it's contaminated by lead particles from automobile exhaust. And 75 years ago, well-known industrialists like General Motors' Alfred Sloan and Charles Kettering, remember today for having founded the prestigious Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and the powerful brothers, Pierre and Irene DuPont, they added to their substantial fortunes and did the planet very dirty service by disregarding the common sense truth that no good can come from burning a long-known poison in internal combustion engines. They did it anyhow. And so that's how we got the lead in. Lead is a poison. It's a neurotoxin. It will sicken and kill every cell that it comes into contact with. It can. It has that potential. But it's been a toxin for over 3,000 years. If you went back from Greek times and read the work of the poet and physician Nicander and the Roman architect Vitruvius, clear up to the time of Benjamin Franklin, odorless, colorless, tasteless lead can be detected only through chemical analysis, and it's been making people sick all throughout history. Now, you have to look at pesticides, one of our big bugaboos. They're bad. And waste oils are bad. Radioactive materials, including ones I was just discussing, are bad. But lead does not break down over time. It does not vaporize, as some of the other things will do. It never disappears. Never. When it gets in your body, it won't disappear. It stays there and does its dirty work. And for this reason, most of the estimated 7 million tons of lead burned in gasoline in the United States in the 20th century remains there. It's in our soil. You know, I had a friend do a soil sample test out on Long Island. Now, this was a further out than some of the suburbs. the soil was still contaminated by lead. Just imagine living within 2 miles on either side of that highway going out on Long Island. You've got, what, 3 million, a million people living on Long Island? Totally polluted. You can't see it in the air. But where do you think that lead went? It went, it goes up, comes down, goes in the soil. Everything grown in the soil is going to have lead in it. And in fact, worldwide, it's estimated that we are exposed to 500 times greater amounts of lead than background or natural levels. In fact, there was a report by the Britain's Royal Commission of Environmental Pollution concluded that lead was dispersed so widely in the 20th century that there's no place on Earth where you cannot find lead. And lead from mining, from paint, from smelting is still a serious problem. Yeah, they've taken out the gasoline, haven't taken out a lot of other things that we still use. Now, when you get lead exposure, you can go from brain damage to blindness to kidney disease to convulsions and to death. And the effects of pervasive exposure to lower levels of lead are not as easy to determine. It will create aging pigments. And people think that it's not from lead, but it is. And children are the first and worst victims of lead gas because of their immaturity. They're more susceptible to systemic and neurological injury, including a lowered IQ, a lower reading, lower learning abilities, impaired hearing, reduced attention span, hyperactivity, behavioral problems, interference with growth. And because they often go undetected for some time, these maladies are insidious. In adults, if you have too much lead, you can end up with hypertension, cardiovascular disease, particularly strokes and heart attacks and premature death. And lead exposure before or during pregnancy is especially serious. It can harm the mother as well as the developing fetus and cause all kinds of problems with birth defects. And in fact, in Venezuela, where the state oil company sold only leaded gasoline until just 2 years ago, a brand new report shows that 63% of newborn children with blood levels in excess of the so-called safe levels of our government. So that's some of the things that lead can do. It is dangerous. Now, you got it in your body. You want to know, what do I do, Gary, to get this lead out? All right, there are a couple things you can do. I would suggest that you take the EDTA route, the ethylene diamine tetracetic acid, an intravenous drip. You sit in a chair, and they give a painless IV infusion, and over 2 to 2.5 hours, this chelating agent, and chelated comes from the Greek chele, which means claw-like, it goes around the metal, grabs that metal, meaning lead, but also it'll do other metals as well, and takes it out of the system. Then your urine is measured for your minerals because it will also grab on and leach some good minerals. So then the good minerals are put back in the system, the bad minerals are taken out, and depending upon how much exposure you've had, it could take anywhere from 20 to 150 treatments. Generally, treatments are 2 to 3 per week. And so that would be if you were acutely exposed, you'd want to have a really more fast-track approach. If you've had your lead tested, and you can do a hair analysis, which is a very accurate measurement of blood levels, and it's not high, but you have some, then oral chelation would be your best route. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. We'll go on to another call. Your turn. I'm Gary Nall. You're on the air.
Gary?
Hi.
Hi. I've been an ethical vegetarian since 1963 because I believe in kindness, compassion, and justice for all living creatures. And I was in excellent health. Recently, I was exposed to extreme stresses, which compromised my immune system, and I was diagnosed with Candida tropicalis. And I tried everything. I don't know what's the most effective treatment for this type of candidiasis.
What are you doing about your stress?
Well, I try to meditate, but I still have the candida.
You have the candida because you haven't done enough to help your system at the immune level. Do you understand that as long as you are not dealing appropriately with the stress, then 24 hours a day the stress hormones are going to be pumping cortisol, epinephrine, adrenaline into the system. That, in turn, causes the desensitization of your insulin levels, which then cause fluctuation in your blood sugar levels. The fluctuation in the blood sugar levels then causes a reduction in your immune system vis-a-vis the pituitary adrenal axis. Hence, you'll suffer from A, fatigue, B, some mood swings, including a moderate form of depression or anxiety, and C, candida. And that is all what comes from stress. That's just a little bit of what comes from stress. So if I, sure, I could tell you what to do on one level. I can give you a basic protocol, but you have to be very realistic. The basic protocol for candida is not going to do anything to build up your immune system if you have not taken care of the stress. Now, there's a lot of reasons people get candida. Candida is a type of parasitic yeast fungus. It can be anywhere in your smooth tissue, your mouth, your esophagus, your genital tract, intestines. And there is some candida in everyone. Every human being has a small amount. But the healthy bacteria generally supersedes unless you have a weakened immune system. And then the candida becomes candidiasis, which is an infection. And because candidiasis can affect various parts of the body away from where it's at, you can end up with everything from congestion in your sinuses to gastrointestinal problems to vaginitis, constipation, headaches, abdominal pain, bad breath is very common, impotence, memory loss, canker sores, persistent heartburn, joint pain, sore throat, nagging cough, numbness in the face, tingling sensations, acne, even night sweats, and PMS, even white spots on your tongue, and extreme fatigue, and hyperactivity, hypothyroidism, adrenal dysfunction. So you have to be aware that candida septicemia, which is acute and is a form of blood poisoning, and candida, systemic candida, is an overgrowth everywhere in the body, and that's certainly with people with AIDS. You've got to build up your immune system. Finding an appropriate de-stress program is important. You might want to call the Metropolitan Wellness Center and speak with Michael Elner because he's got a good one. Essential fatty acids like black currant seed oil, flaxseed oil, those are good sources to help in the healing of funguses anywhere in the body. Non-dairy acidophilus, and by the way, one of the best is from cabbage and sauerkraut. That's very good. Caprylic acid, that's C-A-P-R-Y-L-I-C. Caprosatin from Ecological Formulas and caprolin from Synergy Plus are also good. These are antifungal agents. Caprylic acid comes from grapefruit seeds. Dioxychlor, D-I-O-X-Y-C-H-L-O-R. That is a stabilized oxygen that destroys the fungus, yet it doesn't hurt the bad one. Garlic, of course. Onions, of course. Very good. Activated quercetin, which works with bromelain and vitamin C, is important. I would also look at glutathione because candida impairs brain function. Remember, candida is a living organism. The byproduct of any living organism is a waste product. The waste product can interfere with the body's ability to function and the brain's ability to think. So you want to protect the brain. Melatonin's good. Glutathione is good. You want to try that. Coenzyme Q10, that's also important. Grapefruit seed extract is able to stop microorganisms. L-cysteine is very, very excellent. Vitamin C, of course, is your number one anti-candida agent. Paudiarco, P-A-U-D-A-R-C-O. It's also known as Lapacho. And I just found out from the natives, Tahobi, T-A-H-E-E-B-O. Now, it is one of the most perfect antibacterial antifungal agents known. Although it does have an alkaloid base, and a small percentage of people may not benefit from its use, most people will. And it's good that you're a vegetarian, but you should be eating fish on this, and no gluten. A lot of vegetarians are unhealthy because they just don't know how to do it. You should also have about 50 grams a day of fiber. Now, for a period of time, I would suggest that you not have oranges and tomatoes, pineapples, and limes in your diet for about 3 weeks, and then add them back gradually. And you've got to keep all away from any household cleaners, chlorinated water, synthetic textiles, damp and moldy places like basements. Stay away from that. And that is how I would go about trying to get a handle. Now, that's the easy approach. That's not even a holistic medical approach, but that's something I believe you could handle, all right?
Thank you.
Okay. I'm Gary Nall, talking about health and nutrition issues, seeing what we can do to help you with your issues. And the number to call, if you'd like to share in this forum, 212-209-2900. That's 209-2900. I've been giving out the wrong number there. Sorry for that. Let me also mention that anyone who wants to overcome any localized infection that is beginning to spread or cause problems, you've got to take the time to do it. Don't think that you can pop a pill and continue being stressed. You'll find that that will not help you overcome the condition. So give yourself a chance to really focus on the conditions. By the way, at least for the people in the greater New York area, on the 27th of this coming month, there's going to be a natural facial rejuvenation lecture for all you people who care about what do I do if I don't want a facelift, but I'm 35, 40, 45, 50, and I got skin discoloration and pigments and wrinkles and bags under my eyes and skin sagging and spider veins on the face and problems with tearing of the eyes and eyelid deformities, all the things, drooping eyes, the things that people have. You want to rejuvenate your face? There's going to be a lecture. And I spoke with the doctor giving the lecture, and he's a nice guy. And I'll give you a phone number if you're interested. You can go. If I was in town, I would go. I'm not sure I will be. If I am, I will, because I'm always interested in what people are doing who are helping us reverse our aging, of the skin in particular. It's 212-252-1942. 212-252-1942. And he said he can hold about 80 people in the space where he's giving a lecture. Good for him. If any of you have announcements that help the public, benefit people, let me know. If I can put them in, I certainly will. Let's take another call. Hi, what's your name? You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
I'm on the air?
Do you want to be on the air?
Yes,
do you want
I
to be
do,
someplace
Gary.
Else?
I had my radio turned down, and I was listening very intently. My name is Ellen, and I wanted to ask you, it's got to do with all of these toxins. I lost a lovely cousin at age 50 to small cell cancer, and he smoked and all of that, but he lived in Stuyvesant Town, and he lived at the far end of it near the river. And as I was using that bus, and I use it a lot, I noticed that huge Con Ed plant right there on 14th Street. And I do know that I believe I've heard two or three other people who are residents there who have suffered from one form of cancer or another. And I never noticed the plant, I don't think, until my cousin died. And I just wondered if there's anything, you know, if it could be in any way implicated, because I think he was 49 or 50, and he's haunted me ever since.
Did he work at the plant?
No, he didn't work there. He did not work there, but
okay. Well,
he lived quite close. He was like in the 500 numbers, you know, right next to it.
Okay, there's a couple of things you can do here. When you have a doubt, and there's no way of knowing at this moment until you do your homework, then start to create a database. First, put out the word on the internet, because that's your largest single avenue for connecting with other people.
Yeah.
And ask them, has anyone any information concerning a high level of any illnesses or hotspot illnesses near this plant?
Yeah.
That's one way. Secondly, you can put up posters in the neighborhood or take flyers within, let's say, a two-mile area of the plant and just take a weekend and get up on a flyer saying, I'm doing research just to see if there are any illnesses that have been occurred from people living around this area over a period of such and such years.
Yeah.
Now, maybe there, people wouldn't even recognize that they've had an environmentally related illness.
Yeah, that's
remember,
what I meant.
Remember, until Karen Silkwood brought it to our attention at Kerr McGee that radiation was being leaked, and they knew about it, and they tried to cover it up, and they even contaminated her intentionally. A real dirty part in our history, and David
sure
Sheehan exposed
Gary.
This.
Gary,
we wouldn't know until the people took on some of these massive corporations. It was just one or two people originally took them on. We wouldn't know. So we have to do some homework, and don't rely upon anyone else. Do it. You can do it yourself.
I will.
If it's important to you, then make it something that you put your heart into.
Yeah,
and then see who comes
like
back with information. And then you can start putting that together. Then you go to the university and talk with some epidemiologist about what they might give you as input. Then they'll give you some directives on which known agents, carcinogens, could have caused or contributed to small cell cancer. And then you go one step further. You see how many other people have suffered from this type of illness. And you let people on their questionnaires that return turn them to you or call you say, oh, okay, and then you find out there were five people who suffer from the same kind of cancer over a period of 5 years who live within a mile of the place. Now you got a hot spot. Now you have a red flag. But if no one else says that they've had any kind of illness, and then it may not have anything to do. It may have been due to a smoking or other conditions. We should never automatically assume that something is wrong or there's a guilt by association until we have enough evidence to support it. And for that, we have to dig for that evidence. So that's the approach I would take, all right?
Yes. Gary, I'm sorry, can you tell me what is a good herbal diuretic for getting rid of toxins in the body?
You don't want to try to get rid of toxins through a diuretic.
Oh,
if you do that,
good.
You're going to end up causing electrolyte imbalance. That can affect your heart. It can cause edema. The very thing you're trying to get rid of is extra water weight. And by flushing out electrolytes, you cause an imbalance between the potassium and sodium.
I don't want to do
and
that.
And the sodium pump. And that will drive sodium into the tissue where you don't want it and take potassium out of the cell where you don't want it. So now you've got the reverse of what you're trying to achieve. So don't do it that way. If you want natural diuretics, but not for toxic removal, then what you'll want to do is exercise. The best single diuretic there is exercise, because it naturally speeds up sensible, profuse, and insensible perspiration, allowing the body's water table to be diminished according to the exercise requirements. Now, since the body's number one eliminative organ is the skin, and it's the largest, larger than the liver, larger than the kidneys, larger than the lungs, larger than the colon and rectum, but because we perspire insensibly, virtually unnoticeably, even our feet, the average person in a day who wears socks and shoes will perspire almost a quart of water a day. But because it's done gradually over a period of a whole day, and because shoes are designed to allow evaporation, you don't notice it. Now, if you finish doing a run, you'll notice your socks are wet. But an hour later, the socks are dry if you didn't change them. And at nighttime, you sweat more at nighttime than the daytime. You just don't notice it. Why? Because when you're asleep, your body goes through a slowing down of metabolism. Your basal metabolism rate shifts downward by about 8 to 10%. But the catabolic processes, which are a cleansing and detoxification, increase. So your body speeds up the cleansing process at night, where it's anabolic and energy producing during the daytime. So one of the ways the body does this is it increases perspiration levels, so you sweat more at night. Again, on cotton sheets, there's an allowance for the body to sweat where it evaporates and you don't end up in a pool. But if you notice also, you're wearing blankets, and generally with many people, they wear pajamas, and the sweat goes into that. If you were to take a sheet in the morning, take a shower at night. Everyone should take a shower before they go to bed and brush their teeth and mouthwash and scrape their tongue, clean it. You go to bed. You wake up in the morning, your breath smells. Why? Because overnight, bacteria is growing on the tongue, and you're breathing up bacteria, which allows for it to seed and proliferate in the tongue and the gums. Secondly, the body is covered the whole sheet with dead skin. You can't see it with the naked eye, but you know how you get a sunburn and you peel? Well, that peeling is a very, very pronounced epidermal coming off. You peel hundreds of millions of cells every single day. You just don't see it. But if you looked under a microscope, you would see it. If you took your sheet on a sunny day and you shook it in the room and you looked up at the sun coming through the window, you might catch a prismed effect, a refractory effect, and you'd see millions of particles. Those particles are dead tissue. In the dead tissue, you have the cell, bacterium, sebum. You have waste product that was carried forward. I'm just giving this a little example that the body eliminates toxins. The more water you have, the more toxins you eliminate, the better your hydration level. One way to get rid of edema is to drink enough water, even though water accumulation is the symptom of edema, but it's the appropriate use of water.
Yeah.
Lowering the sodium content, increasing fruits, which increase potassium content, drinking throughout the day, drinking celery juice, apple juice, cucumber juice. Those are natural diuretics that replace minerals as they're allowing the edema and the swelling to be reduced. Vitamin C helps reduce edema as well, as does quercetin, the bioflavonoid. Hope that helps you. All right. We'll take another call. One more call. Your turn. I'm Gary Noll. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. I'm calling regarding, I have one problem that may be the underlying of the other. I have a hypothyroid, but I also have a very big problem, which is my main question, with my circulation. I have phlebitis, and I have varicose veins, very bad on one leg. I'm 40 years old. And they want to remove them, and I can't see that being the answer, being that I've already had something like that done about 15 years ago, and they just come back, or the blood needs to flow somewhere else. So my question is, what do you think is the best way to handle?
Well, how you handle it is first to understand how you created it. Mm-hmm. Look at your lifestyle.
Yes.
What in your lifestyle would have contributed to poor circulation?
Well, I stand for a living. That's one.
What do you do?
I was a hairdresser.
Okay, so that's not good, because you're pulling, when you stand for a living, you're pulling blood down and having a hard time with the venous circulation of getting it back up. It also isn't going to be as oxygenated because of the contraction of the muscle. So what else did you do?
I think also that I did have a baby, which is what made it worse, but I already had a phlebitis before I had the child. And I know that I do eat meat now, and I didn't before, but I was just wondering if my hormone levels, because of the thyroid, could encourage, because I know estrogen could encourage problems with veins, right?
That's correct. Estrogen causes a lot of problems. It increases your likelihood of breast cancer, of endometriosis.
Wonderful.
Of stroke. Why are you eating meat?
Oh, God. No, I don't have a good excuse for that.
God has nothing to do with it.
No, I mean, I have no good excuse for that.
All right, then you're actively eating because you choose to.
Okay.
Now, do you understand that if you choose to eat meat, you also have to choose to accept the consequences? If you want a different consequence, you have to have a different choice. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
In other words, if you don't want to end up with a bloody nose, don't start a fight.
Right.
If you say, I don't want a bloody nose, but, you know, you go up and smack someone, you're going to end up with a bloody nose. So if you look at your condition as an example, the circulatory problems you're discussing are ones that could be prevented. And there are many disorders associated with circulatory problems. You've only come to a few. And what's happening is that fatty deposits form along the walls of the arteries, and it causes them to harden and constrict. And hypertension or high blood pressure results because the blood exerts greater force against the walls of the narrowed and more rigid blood vessels. And hypertension can lead to stroke, angina, kidney damage, and heart attacks. You're only seeing some of the effects. You're also talking about having a thickened blood. So you have to go on a vegetarian diet. You have to start exercising. That will increase circulation. In the legs, you can do deep water running. You can have stationary bicycling. You can do regular bicycling or power walking. You also should be looking at chelation therapy at this point and magnets, sleeping on a magnetic mattress with magnetic leg wraps. You should also look at nutrients like L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10, chlorophyll, drinks, calcium, magnesium, dimethylglycine, choline, and inositol. That's just some. And with that approach, at least you get started. I would suggest that you call and get the advice, at least be on a competent program. I have some protocols that some people are using. I'm still on the road. I'm back until this Saturday. But call 212-252-1942. And ask for one of the holistic physicians who can help you, guide you, so that you make the right changes. But the right choices you can certainly make dietarily. You can start those now. And you should start to see some improvement if you really clean up your diet completely, all right?
You know, I was a vegetarian for a long time, and it was the best I ever looked. People told me I looked too thin, but it was the best I ever looked and felt.
But you decided to look worse and feel bad. Is that... You blew the hair in the wrong direction there, kiddo.
It was the best I ever felt, though, I have to say. It was the best I ever felt, and it's the best my legs ever looked, but it's really bad now.
Okay, well, you can reverse it. That's the good news.
Thank you so much.
All right. You have a nice day. We're out of time. I want you to all have a nice day. And remember, there are positive solutions to every problem. Don't give up hope. We can always find an answer, no matter what's affecting you. I'm Gary Nall. Go to my webpage, GaryNall.com. There's a good place to start getting resource information. If you read 24 hours a day, it would take you 6 months to get all the information that's on there. You all have a nice day, and I'll look forward to sharing more with you tomorrow.